This is the Lattice Training Podcast, where we bring you the best in climbing performance and training from the world's elite athletes, thought leaders, and coaches.
Good afternoon, morning, or evening, wherever you are listening into from around the world. I've got on the show today Eric Hurst, one of the original founding fathers of modern training theory for climbing. I'm mega psyched to get right into the training chat. This episode is going to be hardcore training, and more training. Actually, slightly surreal for me sitting here recording this podcast with Eric, as his book was maybe the second or third that I ever bought for climbing. And really, it was my Bible for training all the way through my 20s. And in many ways, what we've tried to achieve at Lattice has been built upon the foundation of work, theory, and practice of coaches like Eric. So it's really cool to see him, even to this day, making a considerable contribution via books, podcasts, videos, and articles, just absolutely loads. Him and his wife, Lisa, have also raised two boys who are incredible athletes themselves. And I'm going to guess probably a product of Eric's know-how. But first up, a big welcome to Eric. I'm really psyched to have you here.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here, Tom. And I appreciate the kind of introduction. I think you oversold me maybe a little bit, but I'm humbled by your words.
Well, before I get going, I just want to give a rough formula for how I want to run this interview, because I think there's almost like an unlimited number of things that I could cover, but limited time. So my view is that you have an almost unrivaled breadth of experience directly within training results or approaches. And what I want to do is dive into each main topic or tool of physical training and find out three main areas where we can understand the previous generation's mistakes, where we're at now, and then what's coming in the future with these. And we'll just take them one by one, and then I'll get your thoughts, Eric, on each of those areas. That sounds cool.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay, so topic one, and it's a real favorite of mine, so I had to start with this one, and that's endurance training. So I'd love to hear your thoughts about, first up, where it originally went with endurance training and some of those early mistakes made with that approach to training.
You know, the climbers of my generation that were climbing hard, let's say in the 80s into the 90s, we trained pretty much, you know, intuitive ways. There wasn't climbing science. There weren't climbing coaches. There was very little published material available. In the 80s, there was none relating to climbing performance. And so intuitively, how do you train for climbing endurance? Well, you climb and get pumped, and then you climb and get pumped again, and then you climb and get pumped some more. And that was quite simply how people trained endurance. And we now know, I understand pretty conclusively, that is a failed technique. It works in the short term. You get short-term adaptations that result from the climb to failure approach. But to really grow endurance in the long term takes a much more sophisticated approach based on how the bioenergetic systems work to create ATP in the working muscles. And, you know, when you get pumped and you're forearms burn, and eventually your finger force fails, it's a fail of the anaerobic alactic energy system. And so, again, the climb until you pump, climb until you fail approach seems intuitively to stress that system and make it stronger. But interestingly, that anaerobic lactic energy system is the least trainable of the three energy systems. And so you can only make it so big. There are definitive limitations. The way to grow endurance is to actually develop a stronger aerobic energy system and, interestingly, to get stronger, your absolute strength, that anaerobic alactic energy system, kind of that peak finger force. And so by, you know, those are, you know, that's kind of the opposite ends of the spectrum. Pure force and power at one end, and then aerobic endurance at the other. And so you might say, well, that's not training the anaerobic alactic system, which is in between, but it is, because you create a bridge that actually helps you, that anaerobic lactic system last longer. It's a finite reserve, and you get it to last longer by strengthening the other energy system. So it takes a much more sophisticated approach, and I don't think we yet know exactly, you know, what is the best strategy of putting those pieces together, but we're a lot further along than we were 20 years ago. And climbers who just climb to failure constantly actually, I believe, end up getting negative results, because the chronic acidosis in the finger flexor muscles has a negative effect on mitochondria, which are the, you know, powerhouses that generate ATP, you know, via respiration. And so if you're reducing your mitochondria efficiency or content from chronic acidosis, you are actually losing endurance. And that's something that actually my generation discovered, is that constant climb till you're pumped approach, though it gets you short-term results, in the long term, you actually find yourself getting, your endurance waning, which generically we call overtraining. And so, of course, rule number one in modern day training is to, is to avoid kind of falling into that overtraining syndrome.
And would I be right in saying that nowadays, the approach that you'll take in terms of endurance training is a much more polarized approach of working very, very low intensity, higher volume work, and then, that high intensity interval training work that's more in the kind of almost like the strength spectrum, and then only bringing in that more threshold work when you're coming into sort of peak performance and sort of refining that either aerobic capacity or anaerobic capacity.
Yeah, and this is where some of the coaches and perhaps differ in opinion. And, you know, I don't know if there's anybody who's really looked at the bioenergetics for as long and as closely and thought about it as much as I have. So my opinion might differ. And, you know, some of the confusion when it comes to training these different energy systems and the protocols to use is based on, you know, if you search on the internet for this type of stuff, you're going to find a myriad of papers and articles relating to running and swimming and biking, these steady state sports. Climbing is not a steady state sport. You know, we, you know, do hard moves and then easier moves. We occlude blood flow at times in our forearms and other muscles, and then the blood flow resumes. And so it's, you can't just take what has been published and shown to work or to be the truth in running, let's say, or in track and field or whatnot. You can't just transfer those protocols to climbing. That's a mistake that I made a decade ago. And then I learned as I further went along. And so it's a really complex topic. We could do a whole hour on just this question, Tom. So I'm not sure how to give a more concise answer. But yes, I have been an advocate about the whole polarized approach, where for much of the year, you want to do, you want to be constantly maintaining or even expanding your peak strength and power. And you also want to be improving your aerobic energy system, both climbing specific, in the climbing muscles, but also generalized aerobic system, which I think is underplayed by a lot of coaches and climbers. Though that gives you the foundation to support the anaerobic system. In terms of prescribing individual workouts, then it gets down into nitty-gritty details of different interval training programs and high-intensity interval training, which some of which are hard to apply on a climbing wall because, if you're doing bouldering or routes, you are faced with technical difficulties of hard moves or awkward body positions, which slow you down, which, introduce, instability to the system. And what I've spent the last few years doing is developing training strategies using a tread wall, where you can remove all of those complexities. And so kind of like now I'm going to use an example here, like a runner would go to a track and do an interval workout on the track, where he's able to hit specific speeds and, you know, timing benchmarks and recovery periods and just hit everything perfectly because it's a track. Climbers don't have a track like that unless they have a tread wall where you can set very simple, you know, just basically ladder type routes that don't have technical difficulty, but by changing the angle of the wall, a weight added to the body or the size of the hold grabbed, you can change the intensity. And because it's, you know, you're not climbing boulders or routes with hard, awkward moves, you're not being slowed down or falling off because of that. So you kind of have your quote track to do your interval training on in the form of this tread wall. And I think this is a, if we look to the future, which I know you want me to comment on, I think this is one of the big areas that holds tremendous potential. It's something I've used with my sons extensively here, training them in our home gym the past few years. They are kind of my guinea pigs and I am myself, but I'm just an old climber. You know, they're young guns. And it's more fun to work with them. And I've worked with a few pros that I've had here to test, but you know, most pros don't have access to a tread wall. So this is still kind of in its infancy. But when I get contacted by climbing gyms or coaches and they're like, hey, we're building a training facility, what do we need? The first thing I say is a couple of tread walls. And for climbing gym owners or investors, they don't want to buy a tread wall because they're like, I just spent $1 million on this bouldering area or this lead wall. Why do I need a tread wall? And then I try to explain, you need to think differently. You know, you need a tread wall for the same reason you need a campus board. You know, it's a tool that allows you to train something very specifically with a lot of nuance, which is increasingly important as a climber, moves up the food chain, you know, through the sport. You need more nuanced training and protocols, and the tread wall allows you to target different energy systems. And so, so there's a lot there, but I'll stop talking and see what you have to say.
No, that was absolutely brilliant. And it was funny listening to you talking, because whenever I chat to you, whenever we start kind of talking about something, I'm going, oh my goodness, we should probably just talk about this alone for about 45 minutes or an hour. Yeah. But we have to be careful not to go down a training science theory rabbit hole. So yeah, I will move on, and I will make us stick to our schedule of things to move on to. So let me, without further ado, go the sort of other end of the spectrum, is onto the topic of strength training. And yeah, and I think it'll be interesting to hear what your views are on this, because I feel like there's been a longer history and an earlier peak perhaps in approach and methodology with strength training versus endurance training in climbing. But I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yes. Yes. 100%. So with regard to what we just talked about, you know, the training of the aerobic energy system and how the three energy systems interact, I think we're still in the infancy in that. I think we have a lot of road to go and a lot of improvement to make, but I think I'm on the right track with some of that stuff that we can explore later. But you're right. When it comes to strength training, what the climbers did intuitively 20, 30, even 40 years ago is very similar to what we're doing today. I started climbing in the late 70s as a teenager, when there weren't very many teenage climbers around. And my absolute rock god and idol was a gentleman named John Gill, the famous boulderer, who, as it turns out, he didn't know it, but he was bouldering V10 in 1959. Just insane. He was ahead of his time. And so he was someone that I engaged in my early days as a climbing trainer and coach. And because I thought he was kind of the father. I look at him as the father of training for climbing. And what he was doing back then is what we do now. He was hanging on small edges with one hand. That sounds familiar. That's the lattice board. He was doing pull-ups and one-arm pull-ups with added weight. Well, that's what I see on Instagram, you know, Alex Megos doing every day and a myriad of other climbers. What John Gill did intuitively in the 60s and 70s is what we're doing in 2022. Now, today we have a lot of great tools where we can measure these things and we can collect data. John Gill was a, experiment of one. And then he kind of gave birth to people like me, the next generation. And, my friend, the late, great Todd Skinner was someone who I shared a lot of passionate conversation with, like you and I are talking right now, Tom. That was Todd and I back in the late 1980s, positing how we could train more effectively. And there were others, John Long and Lynn Hill here in the United States, and Wolfgang Gulick, of course, in Europe, and Ben Moon, and we can go through the history of all that stuff. But we all kind of were either training intuitively ourselves, or we were maybe picking up on a couple of things we saw from the people before us. And again, John Gill led the way when it came to finger strength training, and it's what we're doing today. Obviously, we have our protocols a little better understood, and there's been some research. Eva Lopez, the Anderson brothers. There's a few papers out there on fingerboard training, but I don't think there's, quote, a single best protocol. And I think you would probably agree with that too. It depends on the person and what their needs are. And even with hangboard studies, if you put somebody on a hangboard program that's new, they're going to get benefit out of it just because of the novelty. So just because of the paper saying that this hangboard program gave positive results, well, we could probably do 12 different hangboard programs and they would each give somewhat positive results as long as they were novel programs. And so I think there's still a lot to be learned and fleshed out, but I think, beyond the obvious things, it comes down to it being appropriately personalized for the individual.
Yeah, I have to say, like, if I think about the area where strength training is going, it is this understanding of the appropriate individualization of strength training protocol to the athlete, because my goodness, we see such a variance in adaptation to very similar protocols with similar athlete histories across the method. It's just so different. You can throw the same method to two athletes who are almost identical and they'll have completely different response. And it makes you realize how different this is. Like, I'd love to, at the moment you can only do things like going in and having muscle biopsies to understand even those basic things around kind of muscle makeup. But that to me is where a big part of the future lies, because I think it's not just a small effect in that, just chipping away at little 1-3% factors. That particular factor is massive.
Are you suffering from chronic disease? Or maybe you're trying to live to 120 and optimize your health. Either way, the Your Health, Your Story podcast is for you. My name's Casper Schultz, and I've been traveling the world meeting with top doctors and experts in medicine and health with amazing discoveries that are making the incurable curable. I decided I had to share these stories to empower others who are seeking solutions but just couldn't find them. So join us for weekly enlightening discussions on how to beat chronic disease and live an incredibly healthy life that you won't hear about elsewhere.
Yeah, that's right. And the more elite the athlete becomes, the more important these little things come into play. Climbing is, of course, so complex with all the mental and technical aspects, tactical factors that, early on, people can excel with widely different physical capabilities. There's people that climb 5'12 or 7B that can't do a pull-up if they are very skilled in movement and such. But in the higher grades, especially if the route is overhanging, you need to be strong. And so we're not wasting our time collecting all this data that relates to strength. It's a very important thing. But then again, some people, and I think I've made this mistake in the past, so I'm, going to blame myself. Sometimes we fall in love with our data and think it means more than it does. And let me give you a case in point is, you know, one of these things that you've been involved with that I love is building these databases, a database of key performance indicators. And that's fantastic. Let's keep it going. But, you know, the data collection needs to be properly controlled. You know, if you're going to test yourself and then see how you rank or how you compare, well, were the conditions the same when you were tested in terms of rest days and the time of day and the ambient conditions and what you ate before you worked out? And there's a myriad of things that will impact the you know, what you actually measure on that day. And here's something else. Assuming you get an accurate measurement, and then you go to the chart and it says, well, this finger force correlates with this grade. You know, again, that doesn't mean you're going to climb that grade. And I'm going to use myself as an example. I know a couple of the databases seem to indicate that if you can hold your body weight on a 20 millimeter edge, one hand. So if you, in other words, if your finger force with one hand is about equal to your body weight, that seems to correlate quite often with people climbing 8B plus, you know, 514A.
Or more.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that is my finger force right now on a good day, is I can squeeze my body weight, but yet I've never climbed that grade. So why is that? Well, it's not because I lack the technique, and it's not because I lack the mental skills. I've been climbing 45 years. I pride myself on having very good technique and mental control. You know, I'm a veteran climber, so of course I should be quite good in those areas. And so then if I have this finger force and I have the technique in the mind, why am I not out doing AP plus this weekend at the Red River Gorge? Well, I mean, I think there's a number of reasons, but I think, you know, analyzing myself fairly, I think it's what is between my fingers and my toes. That is what is preventing me. It's like, applying finger force is important, but it's also, you know, you need to create tension between your fingers and toes. You know, we don't climb a route like a campus board. We climb a route with our hands and feet, twisting and turning our body and creating tension so that we can move in the most efficient and effective ways. And my analysis is, I have a 58-year-old body. My joints ache. My connective tissues are 58 years old, although I think I'm a very healthy person for my age. I can't create this steely connection between my fingers and toes the way, say, my sons can. And so I think my limiting constraint is not the finger force, but it's, again, what is connecting my fingers and toes. And I don't want to go beyond that, you know, to what I need to work on. That's kind of my own battle every day. But, you know, there's just so much more to climbing than just finger force, though it is important.
Yeah, yeah. It's a funny old topic, and it does get people really either very passionate or riled up or excited or confused or all sorts of different things, because I think it's very simplistic in the sense that it's a very understandable piece of data that people can collect. But they will often overly weight it in terms of their performance or what it means that they, and I'm doing air quotes right now, should climb. Mm-hmm. Rather than, I always feel like basic performance metrics like this should be, one, a tool for identifying where you may put your focus in your climbing and areas to look at. So for you, example, is that if I pull out a climber that is scoring way above what I would expect them to on their finger strength, but not achieving the grade, for me, normally the first port of call is to then look at other areas. I won't further investigate that level of finger strength.
Right.
I might come back to it with time, but it'll point me to other places. And then secondly, coupled with that is it's a really nice basic performance training metric to track over time and use to assess whether someone is losing basic strength. Sometimes it's quite useful to assess calorific intake and how someone's actually fueling their body and whether they're just reducing their strength and peak force over time. It's those kind of two sides of the equation, I think, is the real value. But we've also fallen into this slight trap that, and I think Lattice is guilty of this as anyone is that we love publishing these little kind of tidbits around, you know, key bits of data. Body weight hangs on a 20 mil edge and how it relates to certain grades, but people take it to the sort of the nth degree beyond what it really should be taken. Then it doesn't mean you should climb this grade or you can't climb another grade. It's a little bit more complex and nuanced than that.
Right. That it sure is. And I agree with everything you just said there. And, you know, more common is what I experience working with, you know, I work mostly with advanced climbers is, you know, their finger force actually isn't what's holding them back when you test them. It's, you know, a lot of the people that want to be tested, well, it's because they train fingers and they're strong and they want to see how strong they are. And then you test them and say, yeah, you are really strong. But the reason you're not climbing the next grade is actually probably not the fingers. It's everything else. And, you know, for younger climbers, you know, climbing's so complex that, you know, you need to climb for many years. You know, I mean, I like to think I'm still improving my technique even after 45 years of climbing. And I think I am in little tiny bits and pieces on specific routes. I still discover new things that, I mean, at my age, I'm looking for things that can save me energy because, you know, that's the smartest thing you can do when you climb is if you can find a way to do a move with a lower ATP cost, you are basically a stronger climber by doing that without being stronger. So, you know, so as an older climber, that's what I'm always seeking. But even as a younger climber, you should be seeking that is, you know, dialing in the mental and technical and tactical game is, you know, that can get you the next grade quickly. Whereas a finger training program might take months or years to get you the next grade by itself. And so, yeah, it's such a complex thing, but yet those numbers are titillating, you know, when we measure them and, you know, seeing the photos on Instagram of these tests being done is titillating. But the reason we don't pay more attention, I guess, to the technical and mental side of things is there are no simple tests or metrics for that. Like you have to assess movement subjectively for the most part. As a coach, I need to see somebody in person and, you know, make these subjective assessments. You know, as a rule of thumb, if somebody makes something look easy, they're a skilled climber. And if they make it look hard, they're a less skilled climber. That's a very crude subjective assessment, but it works. But then when it comes to the mental side of things, again, it's very hard. You know, there's no cut and dried objective tests like there are putting somebody on a finger force device and measuring it. And so I think it's easy to ignore or overlook those areas, even though they are, for many climbers, a gold mine for improvement.
Mm. Well, that leads me absolutely perfectly into the next topic, which is performance profiling. And that's something which I think has gone a certain distance, but I mean, there is a lot further to go with it. Fascinated to hear your sort of perspective on this and where it's come from, where you think we are now, and you know, what's good and bad, and where it's going.
In what context?
Just in terms of testing, collecting data, creating performance markers within climbing. Across climbing, so the performance, the task of performance profiling and physical training is
right. Well, I mean, you know, I'm a trainer and coach. You know, although I don't do as much as I used to because I have other business interests now. But I love data. I'm a scientist by training, and so I naturally enjoy collecting data, whether it's body weight data, body fat data, finger force data, pull up data. I love that kind of stuff. But, you know, again, if you're working with a beginner climber, that stuff really isn't necessary because they just need to learn to climb. They need to learn the basics. And so until somebody's a few years into the sport, I don't think, you know, there's a lot to be gained. I mean, it doesn't hurt to collect the data, but it might almost take you off course and have, you know, the person, you know, become enamored of physical training when really, if they've only been climbing 2 years, there's still so much to be gained just through climbing and practice and getting on different rock types and such, you know, because climbing is first and foremost a skill sport, a technical and mental skill sport. But as someone advances and comes up upon plateaus, I guess that's when I feel they need to really have, they would benefit from a good assessment from somebody like you or I, you know, a coach who has a good array of tools and techniques and experience base to, you know, take some measurements and draw some conclusions. Until you reach that first plateau, I just don't think it's necessary. And so some climbers might reach that plateau in 2 years, and others it might be 10 years until they plateau out. You know, we all kind of progress at different rates for different reasons, you know, how much time you can put into climbing and traveling and so on and so forth. But once you experience that first plateau, then I think it deserves a deeper look where you can collect some data. And so I kind of look at the data as being kind of the dashboard of your car, you know, where you have all the instruments telling you different things. And so, you know, that first assessment you get with a good coach or with a lattice person can be elusive. And I guess you need to include with that not just those physical, you know, objective tests, but if possible, that subjective movement test and, you know, a mental assessment skill test, which again are tougher things to uncover. But if a coach is working with a climber one-on-one, it can be done, you know, again, kind of subjectively by spending a session together, you can unlock some things. But if you're training somebody remotely, largely you're limited to these physical parameters and then prescribing protocols and then checking back in a few months later and making course corrections. And so we have to do the best we can do.
And have you seen anything in the industry which has kind of made you kind of look again or get really excited in terms of that performance profiling from either a technical, tactical, or psychological approach? Because I think I wholeheartedly agree that there's been plenty done on the physical side of things, but it is only one part of the equation. It would be so good if we had some really good either platforms, tools, or quality data or methodologies to go for in those other areas.
Yeah, well, there's been some published research. You know, I'm a member of the International Rock Climbers Researchers Association, and every 2 years we have a symposium where all the researchers in climbing internationally get together and share what they've been working on. And there's been some interesting studies relating to movement quality where they use center of gravity trackers. You know, that's the best way to track a climber on a route, isn't looking at their hands and feet, but tracking their center of gravity. So you can put a sensor on and you can make a video and you can track the path of the center of gravity and glean useful information from the path that they take. And as they, if they climb a route repeatedly, they get more efficient and you can see how that path changes. Obviously how quick it takes them to go up the route and their pace changes with each attempt. So I think there's opportunities to develop, to perhaps utilize again in person technology like that to track things. Udo Neumann from Germany is, you know, I think, you know, I think the expert at assessing movement. He's just put so much deep thought into it. Like you and I do more maybe into physical training things. Udo is the movement guy who really digs deeply and is keen on breaking down videos, competition videos, and comparing different climbers doing the same boulder and looking at the very nuanced differences between the different climbers, some of which might be because of their body size and shape and flexibility, but also just their different approach to taking on a boulder. And some people find more efficient ways than others. And, you know, he takes these videos and draws lines on them and marks the center of gravity. And it's very, I mean, they're all studies of one, but it opens your mind to what is possible. But I think there's still a technology gap. Whereas today we have some of these sensors and finger force detectors that we can use to gather some of the key physical performance indicators. We don't really quite have the tools to do that, you know, when it comes to movement, at least not easily. Again, I think right now the main tools are eyes as a coach, you know, seeing somebody climb and, you know, that subjective assessment. So yeah, it's another area where there's a lot of room to grow here as a sport. You know, climbing just debuted in the Olympics. You know, a lot of the research that we look at in other sports are sports that, you know, track and field have been around for a century or more. And there's been research for decades and decades on. And so, you know, I think it's fun to, or I think it's, you know, accurate to say we're still in the infancy of training for climbing and climbing science and the research. And so there's a lot to, you know, a lot to be done in the coming years and a lot to be gained to help climbers train smarter, reduce injury risk, and, you know, help take the absolute performance level to the next, you know, to the next level.
Yeah. And never enough time either to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is, that's always the problem. I mean, time for coaches, time for athletes. I mean, one good thing about climbing, because of the complexity of the sport, the length of the careers can be very, very long. If you're a professional or even as an amateur, you can continue to improve for decades and you can climb at a high level into your middle ages, middle age, certainly. Whereas a lot of sports, you age out or you physically are out at, you know, many of the Olympic sports by your mid-20s. The endurance activities, people tend to peak more into their 30s. And I think that's kind of more how climbing is. I mean, you know, the best climbers of today, like Megos and Andra and Schubert and, you know, the strong ladies out there, you know, half a dozen of them who have climbed 9A plus, you know, Julia and Margot and Anka, you know, they haven't aged out yet, you know, so it's going to be fun to see them continue into their 30s if they stay motivated, if they avoid injury. And then there's the next generation, the generation of the kids that are 18 to 23 now, man, they're the ones that are going to really take it to the next level and probably benefit from things that folks like Lattice are working on today.
And because of moving slightly onto some sort of the key tools that we all use within training, I'd really like to kind of just break down, I suppose, where you feel like we're at with a few key things that like most climbers are using for their training. And then in particular, where you think people should be looking at in terms of moving forward their own training. So like areas to pay attention to. So for example, the first one I wanted to look at was fingerboard training. That is a sort of, you know, a basic finger strength training tool. But where do you think that people are typically, that you see, missing a gap in terms of their approach to fingerboard training? Are there any obvious gaps that just through historic habits or cultural patterns that we all just follow the other person down the gym doing exactly the same repeater protocol and we go, oh, we should do the same because you see someone else doing it? I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, yeah, this is a rich topic that we could, you know, really spend some time on. You know, again, for the let's say weekend warrior, I don't know if that's a common term in Europe, but in America, we talk about weekend warriors who train in the week and climb on the weekends. And so there's a lot of passionate, I'm kind of a weekend warrior most of the year. And, you know, so you're training on a hangboard or at a gym during the week, and then you're climbing outside. And I think for many of the weekend warriors, they do a really good job training, you know, the physical aspects with the different, you know, protocols, hangboarding and system walling and such. And what they're missing, what's going to get them to the next grade, is actually more time on the rock. So kind of as a global statement, except for the pro climbers and the people that are on endless road trips, I think the average climber, the weekend warrior, the person with a job or in school that's, you know, just climbing part-time, the most important thing they can do beyond what they're doing training is to actually get on the real rock more often, because, you know, climbing is so complex, and there's, as amazing as indoor walls are and system walls are, it's a poor representation of outdoor climbing. It just is, of course. And so the more you can get out on real rock, I think, you know, any weekend warrior or typical climber benefits more by getting on the real rock more. So I think that's step number one. When it comes to the training, there is a lot of copycat training going on. And I think social media drives a lot of that. You know, common thing you see on social media is, you know, people demonstrating what they can campus. Oh, I can do a 1.47, or I can do a 1.58. And so all of a sudden we are get in an internet, an Instagram competition, trying to, take our campusing to the next level, even though it's debatable whether that's going to actually make you a better climber or not. There's a lot of people that are amazing on the campus board that don't climb that well outside. and furthermore, if you're someone who's always trying to like stretch your limits on a campus board, you're going to get hurt because, if you're grabbing that distant rung with a disengaged shoulder, which is what happens when you're trying to campus beyond your abilities, beyond your strength, you end up doing poor technique. And that's one of the reasons there's so many shoulder injuries these days, among other reasons. So I think people have to resist that copycat tendency and, try to take a little more mature approach to their training. When it comes to hangboard training, I'm a big proponent of doing these max hangs, these min edge or max weighted hangs or these one arm hangs, because that is an important technique for taking your peak finger force to the next level. But if that's all you're doing, you're kind of missing the boat, because you can only gain so much strength that way. It's not just an endless, every month you're getting stronger, of course. It's oftentimes, you get a new peak and then you're stuck there for months or seasons. And just doing more and more of the same thing doesn't break that peak. It needs to be mixed up and you need to introduce some novelty into the program. Furthermore, if you're a route climber, and you just obsess on max hangs or min edge hangs, well, that's just anaerobic alactic. That's a 5 second or at most a 10 second effort with a lot of rest in between. And that's not route climbing. You might do that on the hardest move of the route, but most of the route you're operating, at or below that anaerobic threshold where it's the oxidative system. And so you need to, during the week, find ways to, stress that climbing specific aerobic system. I'm thinking, the climbing muscles, the finger flexor muscles, and the muscles in your upper, in your torso, that you want to improve the aerobic capacity, the capillary density, the mitochondria density, increase the enzymes that support the energy systems in those climbing specific muscles. And doing max hangs does none of that, zero. You asked me to mention something that's overlooked. I think hangboard training with less than body weight. I don't know anybody who does that. Very few people do that. But I think there's a lot of value in that, especially if you don't have access to a climbing wall. If you're someone with a hangboard at home and that is your main training tool, then doing the max hangs two sessions a week is a good thing for developing that finger force. But then doing two sessions of less than body weight training, where you're either have a pulley system, you put your feet on an edge or on a chair or some way to unload the hold so that you're operating at just a fraction of body weight and you can stay on the board for several minutes, or you can do, repeaters, 20 sets of repeaters without failing. You're not doing repeaters to failure, you're doing repeaters that you avoid failure. And so this is probably a novel concept to a lot of our listeners. They're saying, wait, training on a hangboard to avoid failure? Yeah, that's actually a training technique. It's how you train the aerobic energy system. Now, you can get on a climbing wall and climb submaximally and do the same thing. But again, what if you don't have access to a climbing wall during the week? Well, then you can do some hangboard training with various protocols that are less than body weight. So, and then you can do a hangboard training protocol that targets the anaerobic lactic energy system that gets you pumped. And so you can train all three energy systems on a hangboard, but you need distinctly different protocols. And it takes discipline to engage them properly, because it's just a hangboard is a tool that's easy to use, but it's easy to misuse as well.
Yeah, we're big fans of the sub body weight fingerboard work.
Yeah, good for you. Yeah,
whether it's like 70%, 50%, 40%, even down to 30% of MVC. I think a lot of climbers that I saw globally became a little bit more aware of it, because during lockdowns and the pandemic, people were forced to train at home with very limited tools, and they start to look around and go, well, how do I train endurance on a fingerboard? And then they came across this concept, and I think there's been a lot more at least familiarity, maybe not buy-in, but certainly familiarity with that particular method of fingerboarding over the last couple of years. It was also good to hear you say about climbers not overly focusing on fingerboard training and not forgetting that the true, you know, the most valuable item here really when it comes to performance and climbing is actually going climbing and going on rock outside. Because a few years back, I was looking through our data sets at all the climbers that I was looking at them performance metrics and going, this is just crazy how strong these people are. They're really strong, really fit. Everything about their physical profile just said, it screamed high level elite, you know, 9As, V13s or more sometimes, really high level, but they just were way, way off these grades. And what I did was I went and spoke to a whole load of them and asked them about the number of days that they were having outside a year climbing on real rock. And nearly all of them were sub 75 days or so a year outside, which effectively is less than 2 days, like less than every weekend, just one day, yes, or 1.5 days across the year. And you suddenly realize that if that's common across that group, it's an issue. If you can't get on rock really regularly through the year, it's going to really put you in a much more awkward position.
Yes, for sure. And I mean, that's something that I can personally relate to, because for most of my climbing life, I am that climber that's less than 75 days a year. And so are my sons, who climb it at a very high level for their age. They have never climbed more than 75 days in a year, because through their youth, they were multi-sport athletes. So they had up to 6 months a year where they didn't climb outside. They would train a little bit at home, but they weren't climbing outside except during their off season from those other sports. And for a lot of people, you know, that are weekend warriors or people like myself, I had a university job for many years. I have my climbing businesses, you know, and I squeeze in as much climbing as I can, but you know, to get out 50, 60, 70 days a year, that's a challenge for a lot of people. And so when I coach people and consult with them, yeah, that's one of the first questions I ask is, how many days a year do you boulder or rock climb outside? And the number is often surprisingly low. And so I try to communicate to them, I know it's hard because, you know, life is tough with jobs and careers and families and bills and all that stuff. But if there's a way to climb outside more often, that, you know, that is just, that's the wild card, you know, in climbing performance. Because when you climb outside, you are improving in all areas. Whereas when you're in a gym on a system wall or a fingerboard, you're developing a much narrower part of your, of this big skill set that climbing demands. And so I guess, Tom, that's why I kind of hold out hope, even at age 58, that I could still make another grade or two upward, is I'm trying to make more room in my schedule now. My wife and I are empty nesters, and I have a climbing business that I can, to some degree, run on the road. And so my goal here the past few years and in the coming years is to try to get beyond that 75-day threshold. So and because I kind of think that might be what it takes for me to get to that next level, is climbing more often and investing more time into individual routes, you know, which is something I haven't done a lot of in the past. I'm not a long-term project kind of guy. But maybe I need to be to take it to the next level. And for my sons, you know, they're 19 and 21. And yes, they grew up with a climbing coach in their house and with a climbing gym in their basement. But they, because they did other sports and only climbed basically 6 months of the year, you know, growing up, I they're kind of, in a way you might say, behind on accumulating skill. And so that's something that I'm trying now. They're both in college now, and so they have an obligation there, but you know, they are trying to get more, they're done with their other sports now that they're in college. They're pro climbers basically. And so they need to find a way to get more days on the rock, because just training in the gym, though it's better than nothing, it's not everything. And really, you know, if you can couple some very personalized, effective gym training with getting outside frequently, 3 days a week, let's say, instead of 1 or 2 days a week, that is when things just, I think for many climbers, go wild and they have a big breakthrough.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know we're sort of running short on time, Eric, and I want to ask, would you mind if I just ask you one more tool and to get your insights on it before sure. we finish up? Have you got time?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so last thing I'm interested to see your views on is the phenomenon of system boards. And, you know, again, those have been around for a long time. I think the Huber brothers were some of the earliest proponents of that very systemized board training, you know, whether it's in a cellar, attic, garage. Mm. And it's evolved into nowadays things like the Kilter board, Moon board, etc. And where do you feel that fits in the training performance spectrum? And is there anything that you feel like it misses still and will take us to the next level in terms of our experiences and value out of system boards?
Yeah, well, I think it is a incredible tool, especially the modern system boards with the app connectivity and the adjustable angle walls, like the Kilter and the Grasshopper and such. I think it's a fantastic tool. It's obviously not, you know, a tool that you can do all of your training on, but it has, you know, certain things that it is beneficial for and other things that it completely misses out on. I think it's amazing, like from a community standpoint, the way the system boards that have apps connected to them now, where boulder problems can be developed and named, and there's a first ascensionist, and then, you know, you can like tick off your route when you do it. And, you know, you have this database of thousands of boulders on this little wall that you, you know, can come in and constantly have access to. It's pretty amazing. And it is in some ways kind of a replacement for going bouldering outside. If you don't have boulders readily available, that system wall opens up, you know, a wide variety of boulder problems and grades right at your fingertips. So that's awesome. But I think the downside is A, if it totally captivates you, a climber, to the point that they just go to the gym and do that, they're missing out on a lot of other important things. And also, you know, by nature of the size of the system board and by nature, you know, people tend to get on those boards and want to project, you know, work things near their limit. You end up, maybe every session turns into a competition with yourself, where you're there to do the next V hard problem, you know, that's at your limit, and you know, check another box. And, you know, because that's very gratifying and fulfilling to do that. It makes you feel good. And again, nothing wrong with that. But if that is every session, if every session is a performance, it's actually not effective training. It's like a soccer player or a football player or name another athlete, another sport. If all they did was competition day, that's not training. That's competition. And so the people that go to the system wall 3 or 4 days a week and just keep pushing themselves on hard routes, they may get short-term gains and short-term pleasure, but I think long-term, it's a failed approach to training. I think the system wall is a great tool to be part of a larger training program that involves a lot of other things. And so that's kind of my perspective. I think it's an incredible advancement. I put it up there, you know, especially the computerized, you know, app-driven system boards. I put it up there with the hangboard and the campus board as being innovations that really change training for climbing. I think it's that important, but it's not everything. It's like if all you did was hangboard, that's kind of a dead end to, you know, climbing training. You know, it's only going to get you so far because it just misses so many things. And system wall is obviously more climbing specific. It's hands and feet. It's movement oriented. You need to try hard. So that's all good. It trains like different, you know, abilities in that regard, but yet it's still quite limited. you know, the average system board route takes you 10 to 20 seconds to do. So that's anaerobic alactic into the beginning mode of the anaerobic lactic. And the oxidative system is basically missing except during the rest breaks. And so in terms of energy system training, it's, you know, kind of always targeting the exact same capability, and therefore has limited, you know, some limitations to it. Now you can go use a system wall in other ways. If you go in there and do a session where you're doing all submaximal routes, or you're doing bouldering 4x4s on a system wall at, you know, way below your limit, well, then all of a sudden you can train other energy systems. But I don't see people very often using system walls that way.
Yeah. Yeah. It's you're right. It's used in quite a one dimensional way, and it is a much more diverse and broad tool if people are to use it in that way. It just requires, my personal feeling is that it needs the next level of sort of user experience within the apps which are connected to them. So, and I think Kilt has just started to address this in the sense that they now have route climbing circuits where they'll timed whether the LEDs change and you can follow loops and circuits. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of do endurance or power endurance training on the boards. But I'd also like to see technique drills or coordination problems go on the board where it's actually developing skill and technique.
Oh, yeah.
As well,
yeah.
You could have a good user experience in that. I think it would be very motivating, very engaging, and very productive for people.
I agree 100%. I think that would be taking it to the next level for sure, is you have the program take you through, you know, a 5-8 level movement sequence.
Yeah.
And then you say, okay, well, give me a 5-9 level movement sequence. And, you know, I think Kilter's pushing the edge on that stuff. I just recently used a Kilter board for the first time and kind of got to see the engineering of it. And it blew my mind. I'm like, I need to have one of these. But it's like, okay, I don't know where to put it, and I don't have the money to buy one for myself. But that was my instinct, was it was just a really remarkable tool. And like you said, there's so much more that can be done with it. One problem, though, is like in a gym setting, because these are expensive and most people can't put one in their home, you go to a gym and, you know, if there's a dozen people using one Kilter board or system wall, and somebody goes in and says, I'm going to do, you know, my circuits, my 2-minute circuits on it, that's kind of hogging the wall, you know? And, you know, there's a lot of other people that want to jump in and do their boulders. And so it's almost like you would need to have, you know, several system walls in a gym, which if I was building a gym, I think I would do that. And I think I would have a Kilter and a moon and, you know, a tension so that you would be able to multiply the variety by having the different companies' boards. And backing up to something I mentioned a while ago is same thing with the tread wall. I think every gym should have not one, but 2 or 3 tread walls, because they are such valuable tools in a completely different way from a tension board, kind of the opposite. The tread wall, again, I envision it and use it and promote it as a tool for training, you know, for doing various interval training protocols and not doing problems like you do on a tension board, but using it simply to target the climbing specific muscles at different intensities with different work rest ratios that will spin up specific energy systems. So, you know, yeah, this is a whole nother level of sophistication to training program design that we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. If there's coaches listening to this, I hope they think it's, you know, I hope they see the value that you and I see in it, because it is next level. It's next level. It's the year 2028 type of stuff that we're talking about here in 2022 for us to maybe see things progress that far.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And by the way, one thing we didn't mention much, and I need to, you know, we've talked a lot about the past, the present, and the future. I think, you know, not enough credit is due to the Germans, Wolfgang Gulick and his coach researcher with the campus board. I mean, that to think that it's been 33 years or something like that You know, when I go to Germany a couple of times, I visited the original campus board just to touch it because it's like a holy grail. What they imagined and, you know, figuring out how to kind of create a form of plyometric training for climbers. It's a very specific tool and it's not meant for a lot of climbers, but if you're a more advanced climber, it's an important tool that we haven't talked about. And, you know, that tool, I mean, I think every climbing gym worth its salt has a campus board, right, these days. And to, you know, think about Wolfgang, you know, kind of appreciating the value of that, you know, 30 plus years ago, he was so far ahead of his time. And I think that that's a tool that is integral. You know, there's no better way to train rate of force development. And actually, I believe connective tissue strength is best developed through a campus board. You know, rate of transfer through connective tissues is a very exciting subject and something that needs to be explored more in research. So it's got several benefits to it, but unfortunately used by the person who's not ready to use it, of course, it's an injury board that will just wreck your fingers, your shoulders, your elbows. You need to be strong enough and have the proprioception to maintain good posture and arm and shoulder position when you're campusing. And so it's kind of a two-edged sword. It's an amazing tool for the right person, but it's totally the wrong tool for a lot of people. And I'll leave it at that. But I just wanted to give that a mention here, since we've talked about a lot of different platforms for training for climbing, that, you know, the campus board is just, it was so far ahead of its time, you know, and to this day is one of the most powerful tools, you know, for the right climber.
Yeah. Well, I feel like just chatting today, I've got another kind of four or five podcasts lined up where I'm like, right, I'm just going to get Eric back on and we'll talk about this and then we'll go through that and then with that. So, yeah, we've got to be careful we don't go on forever with these things. One thing I wanted to give you some space to chat about before you go, because I know this is something that's really important to you, and I think that you've made a big impact already in terms of what you've done with PhysiVantage and the nutritional aspect of climbing performance. It'd be really cool if you could just share with the audience what you're doing with PhysiVantage and what your vision is really with it.
That's right. Well, you know, climbing is, as we've talked, you know, over the past hour, a very complex activity with the mental, the technical, and the physical aspects. And, you know, to really train effectively over the long term and to stay in the game and continue to improve for many years, hopefully decades to come, a climber needs to take a holistic approach and consider all of these things we've talked about. And the one thing we didn't talk about is nutrition and diet. And, you know, that to me is the other side of the training coin. Is, you know, training is a stimulus for getting stronger, you know, building a more bulletproof body and, you know, more strength and endurance. But, you know, the nutrition is the other side of the coin that provides you with the building blocks to build a stronger body and to have the energy level to grow your ability to exert force and have endurance. And, you know, I think for many people, myself included, you know, we just kind of eat intuitively. We eat what we want. We eat for pleasure. And that's fine. I think, you know, eating should be pleasurable. There are certain foods that I just absolutely love and look forward to, and I reward myself with them. But then there are periods where, you know, if you're heading into a performance period, that if you really want to do your best, you need to kind of tighten the strings a little bit and eat more mindfully. With you know, performance in mind and recovery in mind. And so a diet of beer and pizza and fast food isn't going to cut it. And so I've experienced both in my own life in the past, but also in working with hundreds, actually probably thousands of climbers, there's a lot of people that are doing a lot of things right, training right, climbing frequently, you know, trying to improve their mental game. But then when you analyze their nutrition, it's a disaster. You know, they're getting less than 50 grams of protein a day. And then they wonder why they have achy tendons or they recover slowly. Or they don't feed properly during the climbing day, or they overfeed. You know, they go on a bouldering session for 2 hours and are eating tons of food, where you don't need to eat any food if you're just going climbing for 2 hours. You have enough glycogen in your muscles and liver to fuel a 2 hour workout. Though if you're going out for a longer session, you do need to fuel while you're out there. And so it's actually a topic that demands some attention. And as a climber progresses and is trying to, you know, unlock that puzzle to long-term improvement and hopefully avoiding injury, nutrition is something you need to take into mind. And it ultimately needs to be very specific to the sport. You know, you can buy a book on nutrition or listen to generalized nutrition podcasts and gain a lot of good information about healthful eating, you know, eating to live longer and to improve your blood lipids and, you know, avoid diabetes and all that stuff is important for longevity. But climbing specific nutrition is another step beyond that and giving your body the very specific things it needs. And so when it comes to nutrition and especially supplements, there was no company out there to address that specifically for climbers until 3 years ago when I launched PhysiVantage. And so I set out with the help of some scientists and nutritionists, and I kind of knew what I needed to achieve. And we have developed a line. It's now grown to 8 products that are climbing specific, and I think help fill some gaps that could be missing or are missing from most people's diets, and can help many climbers perform better, recover faster, and most importantly, reduce injury. And no, these nutritional supplements aren't silver bullets. I'm always very honest that if you're training wrong and, you know, overtraining or, you know, not climbing much, or you have a crap diet of whole foods, then the supplements can't save you. But if you have a good whole food diet and you train right and you're doing most things right, then I believe climbing performance nutrition can help you do even better, especially for the more advanced climbers where nuance, you know, trying to get that extra percent or two is so important. And so long story short, you know, I launched PhysiVantage here in North America 3 years ago. We just began a distribution of 3 of our products in Europe through the Epic TV shop and through Banana Fingers. And that just began on January 1st. So anybody in Europe listening to this, you can go to the Epic TV shop and see what is there. And you can go to PhysiVantage.com and learn more about all of our nutritional products. Though it's going to take us a year or two to bring the whole product line to Europe because logistics quite difficult.
Yeah, I mean, there is always logistical issues working with Europe and even internally within Europe as well after the whole Brexit palaver. So
yeah, and can I make one more comment before we wrap things up here?
Yeah, of course.
You know, there's a tremendous amount of sports nutrition out there, you know, on the internet and in stores, different supplements and protein powders and this and that that promise all of these things. And of course, the supplement industry is rife with, let's say things that don't deliver what they promise, or you might just say they are snake oil, you know, supplements that say they'll increase your testosterone and make you stronger and, you know, this and that. So I understand that, you know, climbers tend to be very thoughtful and skeptical people. And so when they hear about nutrition supplements and such, they are rightfully skeptical because it is an industry that has a lot of bogus things that are just kind of a waste of money and you piss your money away. But when I founded this company, you know, I staked my reputation on the idea that, you know, these are research-based, you know, science-based products that have value, and I believe tremendous value. They're not for everybody, but if you're doing a lot of the things right that we talked about in this podcast, then nutrition could be another thing to help you unlock more effectiveness in your training and climbing. And, you know, these products, while not for everybody, I think there's tremendous value. And again, they are based on science that I think provides enough evidence to give them a try. And Here in North America, where climbers have been using the PhysiVantage for a few years, the anecdotal evidence speaks for itself in the form of thousands of climbers who have used the product and continue to use the product because it works. And so I am really excited, kind of as a capstone to my long career in training for climbing, to kind of this being something I can give back to the sport and hopefully help climbers enjoy their the sport more for more years and stay in the game longer. And I guess for me, it's a bit self-serving because I first and foremost developed the products for myself to help the aging Coach Hurst stay in the game longer. And I believe nutrition actually has a growing role as you age as an athlete. You more and more have to pay attention to how you eat. A 20-year-old climber can get away with a lot more beer and pizza than a 40-year-old climber can. Right, Tom?
Oh, God, I'm in my 40s. Yeah, I know. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure and an honor to chat to you this evening. I know it's afternoon time, your time, and evening my time. And I'm sure we will get chatting again on a follow-up podcast again at some point, because I know before, sort of off camera, we were chatting about all sorts of different topics. So there's more to come on this, I'm sure. And for everyone listening, we'll put in the show notes links to Eric's web shop and point you towards Training for Climbing, PhysiVantage, etc. So just look there if you want to know anything more about what Eric does. And otherwise, thank you very much for listening. And we will see you on the Lattice podcast again very soon.